Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Welcome to One Nation Indivisible, and apologies for sounding like RFK or possibly even the brainworm that died in his head. I am recovering from whatever is going around that is not COVID, and a very vociferous stint at a soccer tournament this past weekend, and recording this late on Sunday night. The untold story of the 2024 election, or one of the untold stories, is the fact that we no longer exist in a monoculture and certain political parties act like we do. Another way of saying that is we no longer live in a shared reality, but in these fractured, siloed, alternate realities that are reinforced by the algorithms that we willingly give ourselves to and which we hold in our hands for hours upon hours every day. But sometimes the monoculture comes back. Right? Sometimes we return to that day where, or that age where everybody had the same 3 television channels. They watched the same 3 news programs for 30 minutes a day. Everybody understood the same thing to be happening in the world. And the monoculture has kind of surged back for the murder of Charlie Kirk to the point where talking about anything else this week, even though I had other plans, including covering the Religious Liberty Commission, but talking about anything else seems, to be honest, strange. But also, this is my podcast, and believe it or not, I try to stay in my lane. I try to cover those areas of expertise where I do feel like I am an expert. Christian nationalism, the interfacing of religion and the law, the Constitution. And to a certain extent, Charlie Kirk sits within that area of expertise because he was absolutely a Christian nationalist, and he was adept at deploying disinformation, especially Christian nationalist disinformation. And while I try to stay in my lane, I, of course, have feelings on many, many other things for which there are better experts that you can listen to. I'm not trying to be a professional pundit, and I often think you can and should ignore the shitty, skin-deep opinions of pundits who speak authoritatively on a wide range of issues, but without authority on most of those issues. But I do have some authority when it comes to the Constitution. And I do think we can and should explore some of how our coverage as a society and on social media and as a people, how our reaction to this murder unfolded. Because the only thing that we really knew for the bulk of the 48 hours after the videos first surfaced and reports of the shooting first came about, the only thing that we knew was that a gun helped kill Charlie Kirk. That was it. We had no idea about the shooter, or, and this is crucial, the shooter's motivation. We did not know, despite all of the condemnations of political violence, we did not know that this was political violence. And I think that's important, and I think it's interesting that so many groups and people rushed to condemn political violence. Certainly, Charlie Kirk is a political figure. But political violence is the deliberate use of violence to further or achieve a political goal. And things that look like political violence because they are inflicted on a political figure may not be. Because they may not be used to further, or the purpose and intent may not be to further or achieve a political goal. Think about when John Hinckley shot Ronald Reagan. Today, that video would be everywhere in a matter of moments. The sides would be divided into their media silos, where they are rewarded for demonizing the other side and saying the most extreme thing they can. And that other side would rush to condemn political violence of any kind, to not be seen as condoning this. But it turns out that that wasn't really about political violence at all. Hinckley's brain was broken to a certain extent. This was a man who wanted to and was seeking to impress an actress, Jodie Foster, who he saw on screen. And his broken brain told him that the way to do that was to shoot Ronald Reagan. He also thought of hijacking an airplane. He had thought of killing himself. As again, all of this was as a way to become famous to get Jodie Foster's attention. Not political violence, even though it was inflicted on the political figure. Not everything is political violence, though. Certainly, we are in an age where it is becoming more common. We've actually covered real political violence on this podcast when we interviewed Senator John Marty about the assassinations in Minnesota. But oftentimes, we don't find out about, for instance, Hinckley's motivations and about his ideas of hijacking an airplane or killing himself. Certainly not his initial motivations and everything until much later. Often during the trial or after an extensive investigation. Now, that's not to say that evidence doesn't trickle out and things that we can latch onto, pieces of evidence that can feed our preconceived notions and our political hopes and our desires for the tragedy. But the reality is we often just don't know. And again, especially nowadays, in that era of instant gratification and social media and demanding answers for everything, that is unsatisfying. And all of that is complicated by the fact that people who are willing to kill, who are willing to plan out the deliberate murder of another human being, whether for political reasons or other reasons, be they sane or otherwise, these people often have beliefs that do not fit into the nice political boxes that we use to categorize ourselves, or even on the political spectrum as we know it. And that actually makes a little bit of sense, because the kind of person that can plan and execute the murder of another human being must at the very least have some sort of disdain for the political system. If not outright nihilism. I'm honestly not even sure what you would call it, but it does remove them from the nice boxes of moderate or liberal or conservative or whatever parties you want to attach to those labels. Someone who is so willing to go outside of the political system, again, assuming they were motivated by politics, shows that they are not going to fit, almost by definition, into the spectrum that we have in our minds. And so we have this unknown shooter for the immediate aftermath of these videos. We didn't catch them for several days, and that vacuum allows anyone, even people like the President of the United States, to assign to the unknown shooter this political motivation, which may or may not have existed, that most helps their current needs. And it is for this reason that you will very rarely see me joining in the speculation in the wake of an event like this, in the piling on, and the who did what now. I will wade in on tangential issues from time to time, like the idea that thoughts and prayers are going to do anything in the wake of a shooting astounds me and infuriates me, and I think is actually quite harmful. But the reality is that if you are paying attention to what happens, especially in the wake of mass shootings, or in this instance, a lot of what we hear in the first 24 hours is wrong. In fact, this story is particularly useful in showing that, because the FBI has been gutted by morons who are too busy playing around on social media to actually do their job, and they probably wouldn't know how to do their job anyway, but they've been too busy conducting this ideological purge of the law enforcement agencies. So twice we caught suspects and they made big announcements, and it turns out those were not the suspects. We had reports of evidence that played into the anti-trans attacks, which were reported in the media and then had to be retracted. There's plenty of disinformation that is being deliberately pushed, including feeding those same anti-trans attacks. And again, all of this is in service of playing political hot potato with the shooter's identity, which we don't have to do, and I will not do. Someday we will learn what truly motivated this person. And yes, there is some evidence right now to suggest that he was part of a faction that thought Charlie Kirk was not conservative enough. I considered doing a deep dive into this. I'm not going to. Here's the 30 seconds I will give you. One way to think about that faction, not necessarily the shooter, because again, we don't know, but that faction is that they're more original Nazi. And thought of Charlie Kirk as Nazi light, as not Nazi enough. That's a fair summation of the Groyper Army and Nick Fuentes, who runs the Groyper Army's beef with Charlie Kirk. But the reality is that we don't know, and we won't know conclusively for some time. And when we do know, we're still going to be left with the fact that somebody who is so willing to go outside of the political processes is very unlikely to conform to our preconceived notions of political identity. And by then, the moment will have passed. We'll all have moved on. And most of the folks wanting to spin the murder for this or that, well, they'll be done with it too. The one thing we know about the murder of Charlie Kirk, for certain, is that it was a gun. It's the one thing that we know for certainty in the wake of every mass shooting. And because that's all we really know now, and that's all we really knew at that moment, that is what I want to spend the rest of this podcast on, because some of that, certainly the legal justification for the proliferation of guns in our society, is something that I, as a constitutional attorney, do consider within my wheelhouse and feel competent to speak on. And I also think it's worth you understanding where I am coming from, because while I am very in favor of gun control now, that is not always the case. Was not always the case for me, because I grew up with guns. I remember my first hunter's safety course, and really it was just all about gun safety. It was a course that existed to teach people, and especially children, how to exist alongside lethal weapons. This is how you climb over a fence so that you don't plug the muzzle of your shotgun with dirt. They showed us what happens if you fire a shotgun that is plugged with dirt, what that gun, which is made of impossibly strong metal, looks like if you do. Comes out looking like one of those, a steel tube, all of a sudden looks like one of those construction paper lanterns with the slit sides that kids make. Kids about my age, when I first took this course, about 5 years old. I learned how to clean and oil guns, how to disassemble them. I learned to never, ever point a gun at someone, and to always assume that every gun you handled was loaded. I also learned to shoot. I am not a crack shot, but I was a damn good shot. I used to be able to put a 223 round through a quarter at 25 paces. I've shot handguns and shotguns and rifles and game getters, which most people have never heard of, and even muskets, and also AR-15s. We used to shoot these all the time at my family farm in West Virginia.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
A lot of the family were hunters, and I went hunting for the first time again on that farm when I was 12, maybe 13 years old, and there was a lot of it that I really loved. The dark gray of the earliest morning, the mist that slid down the mountains and the hills and into the hollers, the slow, quiet stroll, the stalking through the woods, trying to move without disturbing the equilibrium of the countryside and the forest and the balance of nature. I loved that. That's probably one of the reasons I love getting up at 4:35 a.m. and writing when I'm writing my books. I love that hour. And being out in nature at that time, while trying not to disturb nature, was special. On that first solo, I spotted a buck. It was big. It wasn't huge, but gorgeous. And I actually, when I first spotted him, I could have shot him from right where I stood. But I told myself, I can get a little closer. I can stalk. And that's not how a lot of deer hunting goes these days, right? These days, a lot of people sit in a hide or in a blind, and they watch or they wait for the deer to come. But I was stalking, even though I was comfortably inside my accurate range at the time. And every time I would get a little closer and I would pause to take that shot, and every time I would say, no, I couldn't. I would get a little closer. The reality was, I couldn't. We didn't need the meat, and the idea of snatching a life out of such a beautiful being, that early morning stroll, commune with nature, seemed wrong. And after aiming for maybe the fifth, maybe the sixth, maybe the seventh time, I dropped the muzzle of the rifle without trying to blend in with the woods and stood up straight. And the deer, which was at that time maybe only 30 feet away, bolted. And the muzzle of that gun belonged to a Winchester lever action. It was made in 1873, a serial number somewhere around 130, like number 130 off the assembly line. It was a family favorite on the farm. It's Americana. It's the Wild West. It's bison on the plain. It's history and family history. It's that kind of fetishized history that people talk about when they're talking about guns that they bought at the gun show or at Walmart. That kind of magnified, romanticized history that in nearly every case is utter bullshit. That strand of my family line, the one with the farm and the Winchester lever action, dates back to before the American Revolution. Andrew Lewis, my forefather, was a general who fought alongside George Washington. George Washington corresponded with him. So this is a rare case where that history is there. But for more, for most, this history of fathers passing firearms down to son isn't perpetuated for truth nowadays, but because that nugget lets people believe that the feeling of power that comes with shooting a gun is something else. That the power to destroy, the power of life and death, that power which you hold in your hands and control with a wiggle of your finger is something other than fun. And this is the simple truth about guns that is never talked about. They are fun, and firing them is a power trip. And this fetishizing of history that we so often hear masks the amusement and power that are at the root of America's gun fetish. But that history itself is also an American fetish, and especially when it comes to guns. And after 19 children were murdered by a gun in the Uvalde massacre, one of Texas's U.S. reps, Brian Babin, said, "The United States of America has always had guns. It's our history. We were built on the Judeo-Christian foundation and with guns." Now, definitely not built on the Judeo-Christian foundation, nor do guns have anything to do with that foundation. For the former, see the founding myth. But the history of the Second Amendment is different than what Babin is letting on here. The history of the Second Amendment is not all Lexington and Concord, not all the shot heard around the world. Those well-regulated militias that are mentioned in the Second Amendment, and yes, that language is in there, that language that is so brazenly ignored by the justices on the Supreme Court, who claim to be originalists and textualists, those militias have a long history. Those militias reach back through lynchings and the KKK and back to slavery itself. There is a lot of good evidence that the forefathers who wrote and ratified the Second Amendment wanted to ensure the possibility of a well-regulated militia to deter the inevitability of enslaved persons fighting for their freedom. The Second Amendment and the militia and firearms it protected were meant to put down slave results, to keep one race in shackles and impoverished while the armed race stood on their backs, guns pointed down, just as we were taught in the Hunter Safety course. My friend Carl Bogus is a law professor, who's something of an expert in this history, and he's written extensively about it, and he explains, quote, "The principal instrument for slave control was the militia. Not only that, but," Bogus explains, quote, "in the main, the South had refused to commit her militias to war against the British during the American Revolution, out of fear that if the militias departed, slaves would revolt. But while the militias were effective at slave control, they had proved themselves unequal to the task of fighting a professional army. Bunker Hill was the last militia victory during the Revolution. The Continental Army, aided by the French Navy, won the war," end quote. The real fear was that the federal constitution provided for a militia, and that the federal government would be hostile to slavery at some point in the near future, and then it might disarm the slave patrols. The fear was that if the federal Congress, the Second Amendment was bred of the fear that if the federal Congress had the exclusive right to arm a militia, that the states were screwed because slavery would be ended quite soon and slave revolts would be in the offing. Patrick Henry said as much, specifically mentioned the insurrection of slaves during the debate in the Virginia Ratifying Convention on June 14, 1788. And the concern actually shows up in the editing history of the Second Amendment itself. The original version spoke of, quote, "the security of a free country." But the final version spoke of the security of a free state. The point was to return the power of the militia back to the states, the power of oppressing people who were not right. And Elie Mystal writes about this in his brilliant book, Allow Me to Retort. And I just want to read this. And if you have not read Elie's book, check the show notes and please go read it. Elie writes, this is in the chapter on the Second Amendment. Quote, "Gun rights are not about self-defense. They literally never have been. Gun rights are about menacing, intimidating, and killing racial minorities if necessary. That's why Reagan and company had no problem restricting gun rights when the Black Panthers started to use them. That's why the NRA never speaks up when a law-abiding gun owner who happens to be black is executed on the streets by a cop. The Second Amendment could be rewritten to say, quote, white supremacy being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of white people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. end quote, without any appreciable difference to the laws and rights of gun ownership as currently experienced. People think that the continued mass murder of innocent civilians will, one day, shake Republicans loose from the thrall of the NRA. That will not happen. Republicans will not make the killing stop because they still think that near unfettered access to guns is the only thing keeping them safe from black people. End quote. Again, I highly recommend Ellie's book. And Brian Babin's comment in the wake of Uvalde is interesting for another reason. Because Christian nationalism is intimately tied to guns, and that quote of his about Judeo-Christian founding, being founded on Judeo-Christian foundation and guns, whatever it was, really showcases that Christian nationalism. Christian nationalists don't just fetishize guns, they worship guns. Dr. Sam Perry, who's also a friend of mine and one of the leading experts and researchers on Christian nationalism, he's written countless scholarly articles, two great books on the subject. Both books, by the way, appear on the Christian Nationalist reading list I put together for bookshop.org. Perry wrote about the Christian Nationalist worship of guns for Time magazine in the wake of Uvalde. And he explains the results of a survey that he and his colleagues completed, and I quote, "We found that among white Americans who strongly agreed that the federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation, over two-thirds rejected the idea that the federal government should enact stricter gun laws." Because, Perry writes, Christian nationalists believe, and I quote, "guns are essential to America's core identity for the right. Gun rights are held sacred above every other right." That's not hyperbole. And then he talks about the survey and says, "Among whites who said America should be a Christian nation, more than 4 in 10 named the right to keep and bear arms as the most important right. Not freedom of speech, not even freedom of religion. Gun rights." And those numbers are remarkable and terrifying and damn near immovable barrier. And a damn near immovable barrier on the road to ending gun violence. I've been saying that Christian nationalism is an existential threat to our republic for years, but it's also a threat to your lives and to the lives of our children. And because they can't spend any effort resolving the actual problem, they have to come up with other solutions, which you can't see my air quotes, but solutions that are not solutions. And so in the wake of Uvalde, you get groups like the Federalist, which is funded in part by that dark money ATM, a group known as Donor Trust, which launders donations for the DeVos, Koch, and Mercer families. You get the Federalists using dead children to further their crusade, for instance, against public schools. There was a headline at the time that read, quote, "tragedies like the Texas shooting make a somber case for homeschooling." That's right. In the wake of the Uvalde shooting, the mass murder of children, their response was to call for people to homeschool their kids. And the piece early on, it says, quote, "name-calling, blame-shifting, and calls for gun restrictions fill social media and the public's quest to find a solution. But to protect the most precious innocent lives among us, parents must educate their kids at home." Notice that the obvious solutions are lumped in with name-calling and blame-shifting. But more to the author's point, the callous article was not a solution. It was what the fetishists always accuse everyone else of. It was an attempt to politicize a tragedy, calling for gun control in the wake of a deluge of dead bodies. Laying blame for this massacre at the feet of the public schools is a sinister and disgusting attempt to wedge an issue that dates back to segregation into the mass murder of children. And let's just pause to appreciate the stupidity of suggesting that not going to school will keep your kids safe, because we can't go to a grocery store or the movie theater or churches or synagogues or Sikh temples or concerts or go to college or be on a military base or in a workplace or anywhere else in public in this country, or drive on a road in this country. And we have to factor in, that's just where mass shootings are often occurring. We're not factoring in where the normal mundane gun violence occurs that kills one or two people, which is often in the home or often just out on the road. Gun violence is literally everywhere, including the home. Firearms are the leading cause of death of children and teens in the United States. More American children die by gunfire than police and military members. Every year, 18,000 children and teens are shot and killed or wounded and approximately 3 million are exposed to gun violence. Each month, an average of 70 women are shot and killed by their intimate partner. And in half the mass shootings, the intimate partner or family member is shot. But if you paid any attention to the NRA's political pets, they twisted in angry rhetorical contortions to avoid all discussion of the one and only obvious solution to this. And again, I'm talking about after Uvalde. Babin suggested that the government could bring more people to Christianity. So did Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene. So did Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who wants to change the culture, the heart, and the character of our country by Christians taking over and bringing more people to God. Which is why he's in charge of Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. He wants more Christian nationalism, which was all you saw at the Religious Liberty Commission, just as predicted. Again, we'll do an episode on that at some point. Ted Cruz pontificated on architecture, suggesting that we have something like prisons or castles replacing school buildings. The solution is right there, folks. Amend the Constitution. Abolish the Second Amendment and get rid of the guns. This is not hard. We are the only country in the world that has this problem. And they will do anything to avoid that discussion. There were actually other solutions once upon a time. But that was before the Supreme Court was packed with conservatives and willing to overturn centuries of precedent to pursue their political ends. That was before the court was willing to ignore entire clauses of the Constitution, that militia language, as the bodies pile up. That was before this court was willing to use this imagined version of history and tradition to say that, yeah, you get to basically own any fucking gun you want, no restrictions whatsoever, even though the founders at best contemplated a weapon that could fire one shot every 30 seconds, 20 seconds if you were really good, maybe. And now can fire enough rounds to kill. There were other solutions before this court was packed and broken. And there was a time when I did not think like this, any of this, as I told you. I didn't know any of the history or how broken our Supreme Court was or would be a few years from then. I knew that we had guns and I knew that I liked shooting them and I knew how to be safe shooting them. But I was also a kid of Columbine. I was a junior when Columbine happened, and it was fully a different kind of horror then. Though there certainly was that exploitation of the tragedy to further Christian persecution and martyrdom narratives. There was a story that went around after that mass murder that one of the two murderers asked two different girls, "Do you believe in God?" Or in some retellings, "Are you a Christian?" And she or they answered yes, as though martyred for their faith. But all of the investigations told a different story. The two were brutally murdered, but not martyred. The nice way to think about this would be that it's an attempt to make sense of senseless violence. But it's also possible that that story arose because murder was not enough for American Christians desperate to become martyrs in a country that privileges them at every turn. And Columbine was formative for many of us. My senior year, I participated as one of the few students in an interdisciplinary team of students and teachers and administrators to examine what happened and give ideas about how to prevent it from happening again. And I remember all the adults being constantly focused on the music that the kids were listening to and the clothes that they wore and the bullying and the fact that we were never talking about the guns. And that we were going to implement this peer-to-peer counseling program to keep an eye out for kids who might be bullied and try to help them and look for those kids who might dress a little differently. And look, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed trying to make sure that everybody felt like a part of the community, included. You know, one of my good friends who I still talk to now and then was a straight-up punk rocker. Piercings and tats and black clothes and musical and artistic. He's actually like in a rather well-known band. He's a brilliant artist, but the way he dressed, that was the kind of thing that the administrators, they really wanted us to watch out for, to look for, to pay attention to. and to single them out, even as we were supposed to be trying to put them in. The massacre was really, it was the defining event of high school. And first I remember saying, like, listen, this is not hard. Like, the guns are the problem. And there was that was never a solution that was on the table. Talking about that was never a solution, even then, as a student. And all that time we were just talking about mass shootings. But one of my high school classmates, a kid that I worked with at the local plant nursery, moving bags of mulch and red maple trees and netting Christmas trees, shot himself in the head with a shotgun. And even after all of that, I still didn't consider myself against guns. It was just mental health, or it was just gun safety, or we just needed a less divisive society. All that nonsense you hear from today from people who aren't 17-year-old kids dealing with a collective trauma. I wouldn't change my mind about guns until the summer after I graduated Tulane, when I was elected jury foreman on a murder trial. I was just 22 years old, just out of Tulane, looking for a way to save the world, and I got called for jury duty in Harris County, because that was where my home address was during school. And I'm not going to tell the full story here, but I will tell three pieces of it, because I ended up as jury foreman. My fellow jurors told me I had to go to law school by the end of it, and I had also changed my mind on guns. Now, I made it through voir dire, jury selection, and on to the final jury, because at the time, I didn't have strong feelings about guns or our criminal justice system. But I did have, and I've always had, a strong sense of fairness and justice. And that kicked into overdrive when we were sent back to the jury room. The judge had issued us instructions to elect the foreperson for the jury. We went back to our little room, and the conservative, wealthy white guy tried to take charge of the group. He grabbed a seat at the head of the table, and he said something along the lines of, this is how I remember it, elect me foreman, and I'll get you out of here quickly. Look, he said, and then he paused significantly, trying to make eye contact with people around the room. We all know how this is going to go. And what he meant was that the defendant was black and was therefore guilty. At least that was how I understood it. And by the look on the three black jurors' faces, it was how they understood the comment too. And that's when my sense of fairness and justice took over, and I don't really remember. I don't know what I said. I certainly was not eloquent, not a good speaker back then, but I do remember being angry. And I do know that I've never suffered bullies or injustice, so I stood up and made a pitch that I should be the jury foreman. And I remember calling this guy out to the extent that his face turned an angry shade of red and he sat down. And I was elected foreman almost unanimously. I can't remember if he raised his hand or not. And I also changed my mind on guns. I saw what they did in a different way. And again, without getting into all the details of the case, not because they're uninteresting, they're fascinating actually, but because we don't have the time. The gun was there. The ease and accessibility of a lethal weapon, a machine that is manufactured to end lives, an instrument of death, took a life and ruined many others. If the gun had not been there, this would have been a fistfight, a beatdown for one of the two people involved. Instead, one man took another man's life and shattered many other lives as a result. His own, his children's, his ex-wife, his family, and of course the family of the victim. So much damage and destruction and devastation, so much more than just one death. And that one death would have been more than enough. The death toll is how we measure mass shootings, but it doesn't come close to covering the cost or the damage physically, emotionally, psychologically. We're all forced to bear some sort of completely preventable costs. And anyone who has been through or had children who have done an active shooter drill get the tiniest taste of those costs. The murder case that I was on was a typical case. The attitude of the lawyers in the courtroom and the judge and the bailiff and the reporter made that abundantly clear. There was nothing extraordinary about it. It was devastatingly ordinary. This was America. dead bodies and devastated lives, all because there was a gun there within reach. In any other country, this would have been at worst a fist fight. And by the end of the case, my fellow jurors had told me to go to law school. Now, I had not been considering it before, at least not seriously, and they told me I had to. So that began me on the path away from favoring guns, and it moved me far along. And then I heeded my fellow jurors' advice, and I ended up in law school. And I learned about how broken our criminal justice system is, and how racist it is, and how much depends on your wealth and skin color, or the skin color of your victim, and began to understand that the reason I even made it through voir dire, because I didn't have any strong opinions that were worth noting at the time, was because I had lived a very sheltered and, to a certain extent, privileged life. And there are other reasons that I've also changed my mind on guns. But one that I think you all know is that we measure our lives by gun violence. The same day that Charlie Kirk was shot, there was another mass shooting at a school. We measure our lives by gun violence. In fact, at almost the exact same time Charlie Kirk was being murdered, there was a mass shooting at Evergreen High School in Evergreen, Colorado. Same day, same time. And that would have captured the nation's attention. But for Kirk, we measure our lives and our news by gun violence. We measure our lives by the intervals between mass shootings, or by how it touches our lives personally, as one of the ripples spreading out from the event, like the lives broken but not taken by the murder on which I was a jury foreman. Some of my first memories are learning how to handle guns safely, that class that I took as a five-year-old, a class that I had to take simply because guns existed in the orbit of my little world. My high school experience was shaped and completely reoriented by Columbine. I ended up in law school because of an act of gun violence that's so routine and quotidian, we don't notice it. And I can't even begin to tell you what life is like as a parent, though if you are, you know. And seeing things like Columbine and Sandy Hook and Santa Fe and Uvalde and the next and the next and the next and the omnipresence of gun violence, it shapes all of our lives for far more than we understand. The death tolls are always the headline, but that doesn't begin to account for the impact. The bullets that rip through children's bodies and American society send out those ripples like those stones that are thrown into the water, but the results are far more enduring and devastating. You know that I often say that life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This is a guiding principle of my life and of this podcast. It's not just a tagline, it's something I truly believe. And America has wasted far too much time on bad ideas. Instead of abolishing reproductive freedom, we should abolish the Second Amendment. At this point, that's the only way that we can begin to solve this. Abolish the Second Amendment and outlaw guns. Fine those who refuse into oblivion and use the fines to buy back more guns. It'll take a long time, and people will be dying all along the way. But they're already dying now, and I don't see any other way. Abolish the Second Amendment, or we'll continue to waste American lives, children's lives, our lives, on this bad idea.
This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time. Thank you.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Pro savings days are back at Lowe's. My Lowe's Pro Rewards members save even more with limited-time doorbuster deals. Save $5 on 24-count Contractor's Choice 42-gallon trash bags, now just $14.78. Plus, get your choice select DeWalt Elite Series saw blades for $9.98. Not a Pro Rewards member? Join for free today at Lowe's. Valid through 9/17. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.